It's time to begin the third and final of our Fall 2011 Norton Lectures. Please feel free to go ahead and continue getting your refreshments and find your way to your seats. And if in the lecture you need to refill your coffee, feel free to do so. The Norton Lectures were endowed over 100 years ago by George W. Norton. In 1910, George W. Norton was a Kentucky banker with interest in many parts of Kentucky and was a tremendous donor to the seminary, helped the seminary in many, many ways, and his gifts continue to repay dividends for the Church of Jesus Christ and for the seminary through the endowment of this lectureship. The first Norton lecture was actually delivered in 1914, and so today we continue a 97-year-old tradition here at Southern Seminary. And we are delighted and honored to have as our Fall 2011 Norton lecturer, Jean Bethke Elshtain. She is the Lawrence Spelman Rockefeller Professor of Social and Political Ethics at the University of Chicago Divinity School. Professor Elshtain is a remarkably prolific author, having written over a dozen books and over 600 scholarly essays and articles. Her most recent book is Sovereignty, God, State, and Self, which are her Gifford Lectures at the University of Edinburgh. To name just a few of her honors and activities, she is a fellow at the Bellagio Center of the Rockefeller Foundation. She has been a Phi Beta Kappa lecturer. She holds the McGuire Chair of Ethics at the Library of Congress. And she has received the Goodnow Award, the highest award bestowed by the American Political Science Association for distinguished service to the profession. Before her current post at the University of Chicago, she served on the faculty at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and at Vanderbilt University. She has also held the Levy Chair in the Foundations of American Freedom at Georgetown University. In addition, Professor Elshtain is married and is the mother of 5 children, including 1 adopted grandchild, and she has 4 grandchildren. Won't you welcome Professor Elshtain?
Thank you. Well, good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming out on this misty morning for this lecture. Those of you who were here yesterday, I requested your prayers on behalf of our daughter, Jenny, who was undergoing surgery today. I'm happy to report that surgery was done very early this morning, and she's doing well. So thank you very much, those of you who remembered her. I've enjoyed my time here. I want to thank all of you who made this trip possible and who treated me so well. It's always heartening to be in a setting like this and to encounter people who are quite literally doing the Lord's work in a society in which that isn't always the easiest thing to do. So thank you for inviting me here and permitting me to share a couple of days with you. Now, what I'm going to do this morning is to try something out. I haven't delivered this before, ever, and it's something that is a little difficult to write about, namely, following on from the first 2 lectures about how we think about the human body, about genetic manipulation of the human body, about our own way of dealing with those with infirmities and disabilities. Well, the question this morning is, how do people with certain disabilities in this society and infirmities think about themselves? How are they invited to think about themselves? So I'll be writing from personal experience, and that's not the easiest thing to do if you are, as I am, a critic of what I would call our cheap confessional culture. You know, the culture that asks people to go on daytime television and tell all their deepest, darkest secrets, and then people scream and cry and shout at one another, and then forgiveness comes on the cheap. Well, life is a bit more complicated than that. And I think it's difficult to write about something where you don't want the focus to be exclusively on you, but you want to share certain experiences that help to open up a series of issues or questions or problems that all might consider. Because I don't for a moment think that we are all encased in our own little subjective worlds that nobody else can understand. You know, we are obliged to understand one another, to try to understand one another. And certainly if you're a Christian, you believe that we are born in communio. We are born into community. We are sociable creatures, and we are those who are called to share with others, to share our lives with them, to share our meanings and our purposes with them, and to be in dialogue with others. And that helps to shape the self. You cannot become a self all by yourself. You emerge only in social relationships. So with that, let me begin. I'm going to be talking about neither heroes nor victims, or neither victims nor heroes. I forget which I put first, but and let me add one other thing here. Christians are called to bear witness, to offer up something given what they have seen or what they have shared. And how one does that is often, I think, quite complicated. You're under a certain obligation, it seems to me, but how do you report that? And let me give you an example that's different from the one I'm about to embark on. Years ago, I spent time in Argentina, the end of the 1970s, early 1980s, when Argentina was still under military rule. I was there in 79, and it was the last of three military juntas that ruled, I was going to say governed, but it's not quite what they were doing, that ruled Argentina. And there had been a terrible period of time in the late 70s when the Argentine state embarked on a campaign of terror and abducted, disappeared, tortured, and killed thousands of people, allegedly to root out saboteurs and terrorists. And there were some violent groups trying to undermine the regime. But what the state did in response went way beyond what was necessary to try to stem the tide of violent action. And young people like yourselves were the primary targets. The view was that young people were infected with ideas that were dangerous, and the only way to protect Argentine society was to remove these folks from our midst. So young folks, again, by the tens of thousands, were disappeared, took on the identity of a desaparecido, someone who had been disappeared. Now, I happened on knowledge of this because I was in downtown Buenos Aires in the center of things with the presidential palace, the Casa Rosada, off to one side, and saw, sort of silently keeping vigil, marching in a circle in the center of the plaza, a group of women who wore white scarves, and something was embroidered on the back, and around their necks they wore necklaces with the photo of presumably their child, a young person or sometimes a couple of young people. And I asked my hosts, you know, what is this? What is this all about? No one had told me about it. And they said, oh, those are Las Madres. Those are the mothers of the disappeared. And it turned out these were women who had been brave enough, confronted with this military junta, to defy it by protesting in the behalf of their disappeared children. Their disappeared and presumably tortured and murdered children. And the embroidery on the back of the white scarves symbolize baby diapers, the date of the disappearance of the child, not the date of the birth, but the date of the disappearance. And I spent some time talking to some of the madres and learning more about them. Well, to make this long story short, I found myself, if you will, bearing witness and under an obligation to say something about this, but I didn't know how to do it. I didn't want to simply use their grief and their experience as grist for my mill. Does that make sense to you? I didn't want to further some ends I had simply by using them. So it took me some years to sort it out. And I realized it was a lot easier for people who had a political axe to grind and could just go in and see something going on and then use that experience of others, feed off that. So striking the right tone, bearing witness in a way that calls attention not to yourself, but to what others are going through, is a difficult thing. Now, I was thinking about that as I thought about presenting to you this morning, because the subject is, in a sense, myself, and yet I don't want to call attention simply to myself, but to a larger set of questions and issues of the sort that we have been considering since yesterday. So you can let me know if you think I've succeeded or not. So I'm inviting you in a way to listen and to help me figure out if this is the way to go about it. And I do this in part because I've been asked by a number of people now who said things like, you should really write this off, or you should write something, some kind of memoir about being a polio child in America and so forth, since this is a disease that's been eradicated among us. So those of us who are still alive, who had polio as children, are in a sense the first and the last generation. That is, we're the first generation of polio people to have survived, because of the care we received, to have survived well into adulthood and past. But we're also the last, because there are no more generations, thank God, in America who will have to deal with this. So how does one bear witness to that when one is oneself the subject of it? So forgive this long introduction, but that's what's going on this morning. So I ask for your help in thinking this through. So with that, let me turn to my text. Polio is suddenly a hot topic. This should not surprise us, given our shared cultural urgency to tell our stories. As the World War II generation began to fade from living memory, those recognizing this fact rushed to generate hundreds of films and articles and books and television productions and monuments to the greatest generation. Now that us polios have entered mature age and experienced the onset for tens of thousands of post-polio syndrome that has thrown many for a loop physically and taken them aback psychologically, this creates a perfect storm of the sort that jogs often painful and unpleasant memories and compels people to go public. Nearly all the polio books published over the last decade have been written by polio people themselves or by others who have a friend, a family member, or an acquaintance whose polio had a direct impact on them. Now, no one wants to go to the grave unheard, with his or her story untold. We are a storytelling species. So there's that. There's also the fact of how society names us and how we think of ourselves. If at one point being a polio victim was a stigma, a sign of infirmity, something frightening to behold, now we are told that we are not only survivors but polio heroes who have persevered where lesser souls might have quaked and quivered. Surely, however, post-polios are neither victims nor heroes, just a lot of folks. The estimate is some 600,000 living polio survivors, about half of whom have been hit with this post-polio syndrome. Folks who got a rotten deal once and then a second time, and who, like everyone else, are trying to make the best out of the hands that they have been dealt. It isn't always easy, of course, but life never is. Now, in this lecture, I'm going to explore the phenomenology, the theme of victimization and heroization, if there is such a word. Forgive me for the clunky word. Arguing that the story of polio, whether on the societal or individual level, has lurched between these poles and types of accounts, victim and hero, that ill serve concrete living human beings whose bodies were and are marked by a cruel disease that often laid low the young. So the first account is polio's as victims. Now, in what counted as our hometown newspaper, it was the Fort Collins, Colorado, and my own little village, Timnath, Colorado, had about 180 people in it, and there was no newspaper. So we got the newspaper from the big city then of Fort Collins, which had about 12,000 people at the time. It's now upwards of 100,000, but at the time, about 12,000. So in the Fort Collins, Colorado, and there was a photo of a plucky polio kid staring determinedly at the camera, the hint of a smile on her face, posed with crutches under each arm and her left leg encased in a heavy steel and leather brace. And the photo appeared above the caption, "That kind of spirit polio can't beat!" exclamation point. Now, the plucky kid was me, age 11, and I had been crowned a polio hero, having defeated, according to the article, a crippling disease. And the evidence of that was that I was on my feet. I had learned to walk again, which was really the touchstone. It was the lodestar for polio victims. Being upright, neither bedridden nor wheelchair-bound, was the Olympic medal for us. And I certainly experienced it as a great victory. For all of us polio kids, there were choices, not for the most part voiced, but clear nonetheless. One was what I called giving up, capitulating to the illness and to one's newfound helplessness. A second was triumph over. I refuse to be seen as a victim. I'm normal. I'm going to prove that I'm such. Giving up meant you were an object of pity and maybe even contempt for not having tried. For those of us who opted for triumph over, it was a war, and the end point was victory. And this latter ideal, of course, if you opted for that, meant that the victim-hero dichotomy is in place. It's one or the other. There was no middle ground, and there was scant room for ambiguity. Now, the iconography within which each polio person at that time was lodged as part of the inescapable cultural surround was really drenched in bathos. There were scenes of polio kids lined up in wheelchairs or submitting stoically to painful physical therapy or reveling in the visit of a celebrity to the polio ward as little polio victims beamed at the attention of the celebrity. In my own case, it was Hopalong Cassidy. The cowboy Hopalong Cassidy, who visited the polio ward and handed out little Hopalong Cassidy coins to everybody. Appeals for donations from the March of Dimes invariably featured a plucky kid standing upright, facing the world, braced and crutched, if there is such a word. Now, I confess I rather wanted to be that child. I was plucky, and I was determined, and I could look appealing. Now, it's slightly embarrassing in retrospect, to be sure, but entirely understandable. Getting on your feet meant that you would not be an object of pity, although the victimization backdrop never disappeared. One saw it in the eyes of folks who greeted your parents after church or in other social settings as they voiced their sorrow at your parents' suffering. They, too, were victims, being parents of a polio child. And these same well-meaning folks often gazed at you with doleful eyes. Although you might be up and about with the aid of brace and crutches, you were a victim all the same. Now, those who were Christians tried to place the polio epidemic within a theodicy of some sort. God had something in mind, some purpose. Now, none were so cruel as to suggest that one's victimization was a specific punishment for an unspecified sin. Perhaps some thought this, but that wasn't voiced. So how did us victims' heroes respond to the theodicy question? I think we forget at our peril, if our goal is understanding, the pervasive fact of faith in the lives of the overwhelming majority of American families in the 1950s, the years of the last great polio epidemics. If one was a Christian polio child, one was hard-pressed to make sense of one's sudden paralysis in light of the Christian account, the creation account, first of all, the earth and all that was in it, was brought into being by a loving God who so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son to die for one's sins and those of all humankind. And in our Sunday school, we sang, and I'm sure you know this, hymn, Jesus Loves the Little Children. All the children of the world, be they yellow, black, or white, they are precious in his sight. Jesus loves the little children in the world. So if Jesus loves me, and I am part of a good creation brought into being by a loving God, then I have certainly not been singled out for arbitrary and cruel punishment. But there is a purpose here nonetheless. And the purpose, and I was trying to sort this out, and this is what I came up with at the age of 10, the purpose is that God is putting me to the test, like the early martyrs. If they gave their lives, I can certainly give my best effort and honor God thereby. And the martyrs were not whiners. They didn't shiver and shake in the Roman arena and cry, boo-hoo, why me? So I was not going to do that sort of thing. As well, I understood that God was omniscient, that he knew this would not defeat me, but that did not mean that my own agency made no difference. It made all the difference, as God helps those who help themselves, a saying drummed into my consciousness throughout my 10 years of life. My mother was especially fond of that one. So I was on a quest. My purpose was to pass the test, to prepare myself for any later test that God in his wisdom might put me through. Now, I know this probably wouldn't pass muster in a theology course, but it served the 10-year-old that I was pretty well. For it cannot help but be the case that those of us who could locate our own travail within a powerful teleology, a narrative with a purposive direction that enlisted our efforts to reach its culmination, did better than those who sank into bitterness, convinced that God or someone or something had punished them, that they had become akin to criminals with no idea of what were the crimes that warranted the punishment that they were suffering. Now, to escape the, I'm skipping a little bit here in the interest of time. Let me offer a few additional thoughts on polio's victims. It was impossible for any polio victim and his or her family to escape the victimization designation altogether, even if the child located herself on the other side of the ledger. For this was the preferred designation of the moment, and there was nothing really subtle about it. Victim, however, is an inherently tricky word. We speak indifferently of murder victims and earthquake victims, for example. But there's a huge difference between these two categories. Earthquake victims are utterly random. Seismic shocks do not single out the Smith family on River Road to terrorize or to torment. Now, a murder victim may be random, but there is more often than not someone singled out for death by a murderer, so intentionality is involved. Polio is surely more on the earthquake side of the continuum, and yet many there were, including polio victims and their families, who bore a heavy load of debilitating guilt. You heard parents saying, if only I hadn't let her go swimming on Labor Day, or if only I had stopped him from heading out with his pals for that day at the circus. Circuses are filthy. And from the side of the polio kids, one might hear, I should have done what mom told me and been more careful not to swallow water in the swimming pool. Or I shouldn't have gone to Susie's slumber party. I wasn't supposed to get overtired. Now, plaints of this sort were common and altogether intelligible as people struggled to infuse what was happening to them with purpose and agency. In one's mind, there was the notion, I might have avoided this somehow. For the most part, an avowal of a measure of agency is in fact a good thing. But you can carry it too far and load too much culpability on yourself for something over which you have no control, no full control. Those who understood that they were random victims of a horrible disease, engage their agency in acting out the telos of recovery, even victory over with God's help and that of their family and friends. Those who carried this heavy burden of guilt found their agency glued to the spot, so to speak, to the onslaught of symptoms and the dreaded diagnosis, most often confirmed by a painful spinal tap as a menacingly long needle pierced one's body in order to extract spinal fluid and test it, and you awaited the verdict, thumbs up or thumbs down, with fear or trembling. Lives could be and were forever shadowed by a burden of guilt at a polio diagnosis. My mother and father never got over my polio. For my mother especially, it was a catastrophe. She was certain that there were preventive measures she should have taken. This from a woman who in those days scrubbed the floors twice a day. Now, when it turned out that an excess of cleanliness might itself be to blame, as children in hyper-clean North America were rarely exposed to the poliomyelitis virus and therefore had generated no antibodies against it, it shook parents up all over again. This made the guilt even more devastating, as the measures that my mother took to protect her children from the disease may actually have contributed to one of her children being felled by it. So not only did I not do enough, a parent lamented, what I did may have harmed my child. So to sum up, polio people who got stuck in victimization burnished daily the victim guilt complex of their parents or spouses, thereby inaugurating, at first no doubt inadvertently, a cycle of victim guilt recrimination. Now, what do I mean by inadvertently? For this suggests that at one point the cycle is intentionally maintained. And I mean precisely this. There are certain advantages that flow from being a victim, especially if you are ministered to by a guilt-ridden caregiver who, by definition, can never do enough for you. It was clear to my 10-year-old eyes and ears that a number of the polio kids in Ward F. Children's Hospital, Denver, Colorado, had taken that course, with some going so far as to embrace infantilization, a kind of second babyhood. You know, I'm helpless, it's your job now to do everything for me. Now, I do not mean in any way to diminish the arduous travail of those polio rendered almost completely helpless. For example, those in iron lungs, slated to spend their lives in these infernal yet life-saving machines. For those of us who knowingly wanted to lift the burden of guilt from our parents, even those of us who wanted to do that, usually failed in whole or in part in that effort. Such, it seems to me, is the potency of this victim guilt self-recrimination narrative. It's a very powerful narrative, right? Now let's turn to the polio as heroes, polios as heroes. Now we're by now alert to the direction these reflections will take, given that hero is the opposite side of the victim coin, and further that heroization is always encased within a frame of victimization. The hero triumphs over a catastrophic event or condition or disease, stares it down and overcomes. Many of the important and vital post-polio support groups that now dot the landscape of American civil society tag post-polios as heroes. So, for example, in the state of Tennessee, where I have my home, there's a group called Polio Heroes of Tennessee. That's the name of the support group. Now, in no way, again, do I wish to criticize these efforts. They have made and are making an enormous contribution to the well-being of post-polio persons by drawing them out of isolation, helping them to assuage their initial confusion, often followed by anger and depression at new weaknesses and the loss of powers that they had powerfully and arduously attained in their triumph over the disease. Learning to live with loss and debilitation, perhaps to return to crutches or braces, or for many, this is a terrible defeat, to go back into a wheelchair, to use other euphemistically tagged assistive devices, that is like living out a nightmare for many who thought they were done with all of that kind of stuff. The nightmare is made all the more disagreeable given the pain and fear that is an invariable feature of muscular loss and spasms, breathing difficulties for many, and all the rest. For some post-polios, the prospect of more surgery, lengthy hospitalizations, the precipitous end to one's active life in a career or as a hands-on grandparent, for example, presages serious psychological distress. And none of this is easy to deal with, especially if you located yourself on the heroic triumph over end of the continuum for 30 years or more. Now, the good folks active in the post-polio movement think of hero not so much as moral supererogation going way beyond what is expected, but one is a hero simply for having survived the disease. But to those of us who pushed as hard as we could, who gritted our teeth through the pain of physical therapy, ours was a victory that went way beyond learning to live with polio. We had stared death in the face, which was always a possible denouement with a polio diagnosis, and we were going to clobber polio itself, a knockout, not a TKO. We were, now that we were losing it, getting weaker, for it had been lying in wait all these years, primed to ambush us, we said, enough already. Well, not so, as it turns out. So where does that leave post-polio heroes? Well, it leaves people, I think, in a strange cultural limbo, unless one gracefully accedes to newfound victimization, and I want to explain this. Even as the hero triumphs, the victim recedes, assuming these, again, are the dominant categories framing the cultural narrative. You know, it's one or the other. It follows that as the victim grows in strength, so to speak, the hero weakens. So post-polios are like Superman stuck in a sealed room filled with kryptonite. The kryptonite might not get you right away, but get you it will. This no doubt over-dramatizes, but the heroic narrative did turn us into superheroes in our own eyes, and that of others, at least for a time, until the triumph over came to be regarded as normal and went unremarked, and that is just the way one wanted it. So although I could never run again after I had polio, except in my dreams, I walked all over the place. When I first detected some signs of weakening in the late 1970s and early 1980s, I embarked on an exercise regimen, with walking as the exercise, which it turns out was the worst thing I could have done. Dealing with post-polio is a counterintuitive task. What you think will forestall more weakening, namely exercise, building up muscles, actually does damage because you are generating more wear and tear on already worn out nerve centers, ganglia, that have borne a double or triple burden since the moment that the onset of the disease destroyed these nerve centers, these ganglia that were assigned originally to carry a task that then ancillary ganglia had to take up. And they've been doing double or triple duty and they're tired, they're worn out. This is a rough and ready way to put it, but perhaps you can take the point. Now, it took some time to sort this out. In the meantime, I remember thinking, it isn't going to get me this time around any more than it did the first time, that I would continue to pass. And the big goal, I need to tell you, for polio people was to pass as normal. You know, we know the narratives of African Americans of light skin who were able to pass as white people, and that became the goal. I want to try to pass. To be normal, to be part of the majority. So polio people wanted to pass. They asked for no special favors. If the school had no elevators, one mastered the steps. If a college physical education requirement involved swimming a certain number of laps, one did that. There would be no special norm for oneself. But the inevitable can only be forestalled for so long, especially given the lamentable fact that one's efforts to fight growing weakness were exacerbating the symptoms one hoped to abate or to eradicate altogether. So when one was body slammed with the reality of post-polio, one then faced doctors, if indeed one could find a physician who admitted to the reality of post-polio, who meted out advice that most of the time indicated you were now to live a life that was pretty much a complete turnaround from the life you had been living. If you had been behaving like a hero, you'd been active, achieving, not conceding to your status as a polio victim, for you'd grown out of polio's debilitations. I should tell you that it was very difficult for people to find physicians, because physicians operating today have no familiarity with this disease. It's been eradicated, so they knew nothing about it. So people were constantly being misdiagnosed and being given medication that was completely unnecessary and so forth. You were now told not to use it or lose it, which had been the advice originally, but rather, if you use it, you're going to lose it. Now, for some of us, following this advice would mean or would have meant the end of our lives as we were living them. So you read the books of advice, and one of them says, be active for 10 to 15 minutes and then rest for 5 minutes, and then be active again and rest for five. And I thought, well, okay, how does one do that in an airport concourse when you're racing to try to get a plane? Told to always use wheelchair assist for air travel, my reaction was, have you traveled lately and discovered how erratic our airline efforts to get persons with disabilities to their connecting flights, especially given that, although you may be the first to board, you're often the last to deplane, as the airline doesn't want you to slow other passengers down, as they would be if a disabled passenger got off first and into a wheelchair. You know, it blocks things and slows people down. Now, what follows is a bit of a digression, but I want to give you some of the misadventures of airport travel life. But I think it helps to illustrate the reality of life for people with physical disabilities. So assume that you've asked for wheelchair assist. You should try this experiment sometime. I don't want you to go out and, you know, everyone fake, you know, something permanently, but just, you know, as an experiment. You find a bedraggled and no doubt underpaid wheelchair assist person who pushes the passenger or two with their luggage up the jetway. And one wonders as this process goes forward why jet bridges invariably ascend. You know, why is that? You know, you're getting out with your luggage, and I see people who don't have physical disabilities struggling. It's, you know, in the Nashville airport, there's a particularly sharp incline. All polio people collect stories of what it means in practice to be helped. So I want to give you two of my favorites. This is in a Northern England airport, not New England, but England. I find myself abandoned by one wheelchair assist person with the cheery assurance that another would come along shortly, only to find myself waiting 10 and then 15 minutes outside the airport building itself with a bitterly cold wind and faced with a locked door back into the airport. Now, I knew that if I tried to break back into the building, all the security alerts would jump from orange to red or whatever the British equivalent is, and I would be wrestled to the ground by security agents. So finally someone showed up and tore off at a sprint to get me to my regional airline on time. And of course, what did I face when I got to the regional airline? I had to go up steps to get into the airplane. Very mysterious. But it lacks the flair exhibited at De Gaulle Airport in Paris. Now, I had put in for assistance, as De Gaulle is one of the airports from hell, as anyone who has flown in and out of there will attest. Now, we landed, there was no jet bridge, this was in a 767, and we had to deplane by stairs. This is a big, tall airplane with the buses waiting. And I asked to take us to the concourse, to the terminal. I asked the flight attendant what to do, as I had requested assistance, and she shrugged her shoulders. So relying on the kindness of strangers like Blanche DuBois, Tennessee Williams' famous play, A Streetcar Named Desire, I enlisted a strapping tall fellow to lug my suitcase down the stairs as I struggled to keep my balance and hang on to my overloaded smaller bag laden with books and papers. Now we reached the bottom and I followed the crowd, and he was kind enough to continue to help me, and boarded a bus to go to the airport proper. And just before the doors of the bus were closing, a frantic woman rushed out shouting, "Who was the person who requested help, who requested an assist? Are you the person?" And I said yes, and she then grabbed my suitcase, took it off that bus, and began marching back toward the airplane and the stairs we had just come down as we deplaned the Boeing 767. Now, I followed her, of course, as I never separate from my bag. And she started lugging the bag back up the steps, ordering me to follow her, even though I was the one who needed help. And I protested that going up steps was more difficult for me than descending, and there was no response. I could scarcely believe that this French farce was actually being played out, so I staggered after her, nearly stumbling and falling in the process. We reached the top. I was panting, and I was told to stand there and wait. 5 minutes later, some infernal contraption that looked like a stainless steel or tin cabin of some sort was hoisted aloft on the other side of the plane, and I was told to get into it, to this thing. It was connected to the airplane. And I got in with my bags, and it was cold and it was dirty, and there was some trash in one of the corners. And the driver then sort of disentangled this thing from the plane and drove, sort of juddering all the way, to an airport concourse bridge where another person was poised to open a side exit. So they connected this thing to the concourse exit, and I deplaned directly from this nasty contraption to the concourse, and then I was told to wait. No one was there with a wheelchair, and I thought, thanks, but no thanks. Let me out of here. And I began walking in a direction that looked like it might be an exit. And presently, I heard a frantic voice behind me calling, "Madam, madam." And I turned as this determined fellow, with his long hair flying, caught up with me and pushed me into the wheelchair, where I clearly belonged, and wheeled me out to the exit. Now, I'm pleased to report that after all this silliness, I did connect up with a gracious graduate student who accompanied me on the train to Lyon, where I had a very good time. But the reader, or the listener in this case, will, I hope, appreciate why post-polios who remain ambulatory may well opt for thanks but no thanks when it comes to wheelchair assist. My view is maybe someday it will be absolutely necessary, but for now, I think I'll rely as much as possible on my own two legs, however gimpy they may be. Now, back to the main narrative. Being a polio hero in your own eyes, and that of the culture more generally, given the premium Americans place on individualism and self-help, meant never asking for help. And I recall well the days when I was hauling around four children under the age of seven, grocery shopping, unloading the groceries myself, doing the house cleaning. One had to scrub the floors by hand because my grandmother had taught me that was the only way to really get them clean. All four children came with me to the laundromat much of the time, as we had neither a washer nor dryer in those lean days. And sometimes I hauled the heavy, wet laundry back home in order to hang it on a clothesline in the backyard because it saved a few dollars. And I was studying for my PhD at the same time. Now, it may seem odd and it may seem perverse, but relinquishing those tasks over time was not an unalloyed relief to me, because it signified a failure of some sort. One was no longer completely normal. One couldn't do all these things without help. because us heroes defined our lives as can-do. Those who remained victims were won't-do, as in many cases they did not engage their agency to get better. But now we were being told that our agency must push us in the direction of you should not do it, even if you can. So we confronted this double whammy. First, our bodies did not permit us to do many things we had once done with ease, and second, as if that weren't enough, we were being ordered more or less to relinquish even more. So with that, let me turn to a few concluding thoughts under the rubric neither victims nor heroes. Now, I see a number of possibilities in light of these realities, including a cultural surround largely ignorant of the long polio story, as it is a disease that has disappeared among us in the developed West, indeed, in most of the world. Unacknowledged as triumph over by persons who have forgotten the left alive polio people, the narrative nonetheless defines us, or better yet, yields a particular repertoire of possibilities. Unsurprisingly, the first choice is to acknowledge the advice and the therapeutic wisdom of post-polio diagnosis, but to say thanks but no thanks, thereby keeping the heroic self-understanding, battered as it may be, alive. Here the polio person takes a calculated risk that the cessation or radical abatement of the powers one is drawn upon to carry on and to live one's life will not happen precipitously and all at once. And when that happens, one will deal with it. A second response is to re-victimize oneself. However much the post-polio activists may speak of us as polio heroes, one thinks, here it goes again, singling me out, why me? I am a victim. If the person has regained functions and capabilities, these are put on the shelf as the person may go beyond the post-polio recommendations to cease and desist. One returns to helplessness. Now, I doubt there are many who inhabit this identity full bore, but I have seen this dynamic in action. So the option is one that I think it's important to identify. The third option is to struggle to break out of this victim-hero scenario, if one can. One is no longer a child. The world is filled with good and ill. On some level, one is a victim, but one refuses to identify as such. You resist the blandishments of a popular culture that feasts on victimization, which is one of the least savory aspects of contemporary identity politics. On some level, you are also a hero. But even heroes slow down. They get tired. They grow old. You recognize that you have not been singled out for yet another travail over which you must triumph. Rather, you confront, as all human beings must, mortality, the loss of powers. If you are a hero, you decide it is of the quotidian sort, a heroism you share with hundreds of thousands of ordinary people who both flourish and fail in their lifelong pilgrimage. You may not be a polio kid anymore, but you have reason to feel some pride at how you dealt with what was dealt you. But there's no secure triumph over, as you once believed. But neither did you capitulate. And that, I think, is enough. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thanks. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much.
It's time for some questions. Professor Elstein will take some questions and seek to respond. The two microphones, please make your way to the front. Don't be afraid. Dr. Johnson.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank
this
you.
Was a delight. I have so many thoughts. One of them is we need heroes.
Mm-hmm.
Our culture is idolatrous, shall we say.
Yes.
And, of course, this quest for for heroes can go very sour.
Sure.
Personally,
sure.
Focused sure. on others. However, is there not something in the human condition that needs heroes and that needs the right kind of hero to encourage us on?
Yeah. Yeah.
It seems so fitting that you would say what you said, and maybe that's a part of the right kind of heroism, is that you would deflect such attention from yourself. But maybe it's the task of the community to nonetheless insist of our need and to seek to encourage this. When one thinks of the Gospels, it seems as if that may be a subtext of the Gospels, that we're not to seek positions of the kind of heroism that maybe the world looks for, but that blessed are the poor in spirit, and blessed are those who mourn, because the kingdom is for such as these.
Yes. Thank you. That's thank you very much. That's a great question. And as you were speaking, I thought of a conversation I had with my late friend, the historian Christopher Lash. One of my last conversations with him before he died, much too young. And he was lamenting the difference between the hero and the celebrity, and said that in our culture today, we've confused the two, that we have celebrities, and we lionize all sorts of people who haven't accomplished much at all. They're famous for being famous. You know, they're in the news for being notorious. They're beautiful, and you know, they're on the screen before us, and so on and so forth. So we've displaced, you know, this, I took him to be sane, this yearning for a hero. And I think you're right, all cultures have some search for a hero of some kind. We've displaced it onto celebrity, where it ongoingly disappoints us. And that makes it easy for us to lift up a person and then to besmirch them and crash them down. We do that all the time. Someone's a great hero, and then we go after them and destroy them. You know, look at what happened to Tiger Woods, you know, the great, great golf hero, and then we find out about his less than stellar, what shall we call this? Sexual ethic, I guess. And the full force of ire and disappointment descends upon him. And that tells me that we placed way too much on him in the first place to be a hero for us, and a hero as a celebrity. So when he disappoints, it turns very ugly. We do need heroes, I think you're right. And I think what Christianity did when it entered the world originally was to challenge, not sort of head on, but it challenged the then dominant myth of the hero, certainly in the antique Greek world, of the Homeric warrior hero. These were not heroes of the sort we should embrace. And you could see heroism in small things, really, those quotidian things that I talked about. You know, people who care for and serve others. People who engage in the simple tasks that make life less brutal. So perhaps the word for such people would be, you know, exemplars and so forth, people who help to show us a way of being in the world that's worthy of endorsement. And often this does not shout from the mountaintops. I mean, we need to seek this out, or we discover we're in the midst of this. We face someone who turns out to be such. Some of us were lucky enough to find an exemplar of that sort when we were undergraduate students. You know, someone who inhabited the role of professor so beautifully that you say, that's the way it should be. That's what it means to be a teacher. And one lifts that up and remembers that as one goes along. So how we chip away at this false celebrity culture that constantly disappoints us and look for heroes in the right places, if you will, in the quotidian deeds that are carried out with some conviction and some seriousness of purpose and an appropriate sense of humility. I think that obviously is the direction we should go, and Christians above all should lead in that. Because Christianity was a message that was not preached for the high and mighty exclusively. You know, it was meant for the fisherman. It was meant for the woman holding her baby. It was meant for ordinary people. We recall that when St. Augustine first confronted Scripture, he was offended by it. Augustine was trained in the great tradition of classical rhetoric. And he said, I was offended by the rough way that God's word was spoken. You know, it wasn't this elegant language and so forth. He said, I had to get used to that. There are others who've written, who are by no means Christian, who've written about the infusion of ordinary life with extraordinary importance and purpose that came through Christianity. Again, quite in defiance of the dominant sort of modalities of the antique world. So Christians are the ones who should keep this alive and who should try to resist this culture of celebrity. And I don't think we do a very good job of that because it's all around us, this culture of celebrity. But perhaps we can at least minimally recognize that this is a form of idolatry. This is a way of worshiping at false idols. You know, we set certain people up only to knock them down. And it satisfies some aggressive urge in us as well. You know, sort of schadenfreude, sort of joy at people being destroyed. So it brings out the worst in us, even as it loads an impossible burden on often unworthy people, you know, who may be beautiful and may be accomplished and within a sort of narrow band, but are by no means exemplars in the way in which I've been talking about it. So you have suggested something very interesting that I need to think about further, of how we create space for and recognize heroes of the sort you're talking about, and honor them. But in a way that keeps their accomplishments within reach of all of us. It's not, you know, it's not way out there, and we can never aspire to it. You know, I remember when I was, you know, 10, 11, 12, and so on, you know, I wanted to look like Elizabeth Taylor, you know. There were the photographs of her on Photoplay magazine, which I love to look at, these beautiful people. And... you know, and of course, there's only one person who looked like that. And try as one might, one would never look like that. But, you know, there was something about that aesthetic ideal, that drew one in. Now, if you really got overtaken by that, your life could be a wreck, you know, because your life would always be unworthy if you didn't achieve something like looking like that. Fortunately, I knew even as I wanted to look like that, that there was something basically kind of silly about it on some level, and was not, my life wasn't overtaken by it. But our lives can readily be overtaken by this. And I think ever more so, given the pervasiveness of the media in our lives, where it isn't just a place we visit from time to time. It's infused in our lives constantly. We're bombarded with it. We cannot avoid it. So how do we sort this out? And this is where I think Christians could do a better job of serving in their churches as, what should we call it, interpreters of the culture, helping us to better understand the dynamics of popular culture and what it calls us to and the way in which it helps to set up false gods. And yet at the same time, there are some real accomplishments here. There are some real rewards that are rightly given for people who act beautifully or sing beautifully or direct beautifully. And we do well to honor that. But that doesn't mean that these are folks in a world apart from the rest of us. How you accomplish all of that is a tall order. But, you know, the churches do a very good job in their social ministries And it is impressive and humbling thing. But I don't think we do a very good job in what might be called our cultural ministries, in helping us to think through, all of you in the room, to think through the culture and its demands and how we can interpret them and deal with them. I think that's something we really need to work at. And this is one theme that should be part of it.
Other questions? Don't be afraid.
Looks like we're done.
Well, if I may ask one question.
Sure.
On theodicy, you mentioned the theodicy of the polio persons and of their families. What about theodicy? Are the persons who are not afflicted by polio directly, and more generally, those who are not afflicted by disabilities generally, also faced with a theodicy question as they view the inequality?
Sure.
Why is one suffering?
Sure. Absolutely. I mean, those who are not afflicted, as you say, do face that. And in fact, we see it in what's called survivor's guilt. There are books on this. For example, those who survived the dropping of the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, their lives have often been blighted by the fact that they survived that cataclysm. And there's even a name for it in Japanese, which I'm going to mangle if I try to say it. It's a phenomenon that was so pervasive it was recognized and written about, and Japanese society attempted to deal with it given its own cultural resources. But it was the view that I should not be alive. You know, my whole family's dead, and I should not be alive. This is something confronted by soldiers in a war who see the person next to them, their best buddy, suddenly shot through the head, dead in a flash, and yet I survive. How come me? So it is something faced by all of us in one way or the other, whether one is the one who is harmed and afflicted or one is the one who is not. And how people in those different circumstances try to work this out, I think, is not an easy thing. It's this theodicy question that has served as a stumbling block for many who are entirely sympathetic to Christianity in many ways, but can't get their minds around that issue. So, for example, the great French writer and moralist Albert Camus, who was in a lifelong dialogue with Christianity, could not get past the fact of the suffering and torture of children. And he kept saying, if there is an all-powerful, beneficent God, why does this happen? How can this happen? Now, I think we could say to Camus, well, your view of God is somewhat antiquated and we've got new understandings, but certainly in his time and place, that was the question that haunted him and that he couldn't get around. And I think it is still a stumbling block for many, because our view of God often is still of someone who, some anthropomorphic power who can directly, come around and directly meddle and things. But then you've got the question, if that's true, why is this child kidnapped, tortured, and murdered, and this child not? Do we want a God that singles people out in that way? Surely not. Surely not. So what understanding of God, then, are we working with to say, God doesn't do that? I remember someone asking me, where was God on 9/11? And my response, however inadequate it may have been, was, God was on those airplanes with the people who were about to be plowed into the building. God was with those poor souls who were in the buildings as they crashed. That's where God was that day. He certainly wasn't with the murderers. And I think that if you embrace the notion of a God who suffers with humanity, and has left behind the Holy Spirit to work in the world, that perhaps you can struggle in a rather different way with this issue and not think of it as God directly singling out, you, to be hurt and you to be blessed. Because again, I think none of us wants to believe in that sort of God.
There's another question.
I do have one question.
Sure.
It's regarding hero making in Christian culture and how, when it comes to, for instance, numbers of attendance at a church, there's a strong culture that sort of glorifies megachurch pastor.
Say a little louder.
There's somewhat of a culture that glorifies megachurch pastors.
Yes.
And pastors who are able to draw large numbers,
yeah,
rewarded with bigger salaries, et
cetera. Yeah.
How do we as Christians, in fact, I was reading a blog post the other day where this writer, Dr. Ephraim Smith, was talking about the difference between pastoring as more of a king, like an Old Testament king, versus pastoring like Jesus or Paul, and sort of the different models there,
mm-hmm,
with, you know, assistants and servants, et cetera, and then,
mm-hmm,
you have Jesus saying, you know, I'm a servant, and washing,
yeah,
the apostles' feet. How do we as Christians sort of challenge that and shift, I guess you could say, that narrative where it fits more in alignment with the modelhood of Jesus,
yeah,
versus the other, and,
yeah,
in contrast to the
right.
celebrity culture of America?
Well, I have to say that I've never been much impressed with pastors who have, you know, diamond rings on each finger and drive really fancy cars. That doesn't, and somehow that these material rewards are theirs, that have come their way as a result of God's blessings. I don't think that's the way God showers blessings on us. And yet I know that's attractive to many, but it's based, is it not, on a rather crude notion that God rewards us through this material success. And we must exhibit, it is our obligation to exhibit the signs of this success, even in excessive ways, to demonstrate to people what they can somehow get if they just have faith enough. And I think it suggests that if you don't receive these material rewards, your faith is somehow wanting. And I think that's a very cruel and a false thing. I don't think there's any real theological warrant for claims of that sort. Let me tell you what I thought of as you were asking your question. When Pope John Paul II died, someone took a photograph of what he left behind, the things that he owned. There was a pair of shoes, his crucifix, a couple of photos of his family, his breviary, his prayer book, and that was it. And his Bible. That was it. That was it. Something like five items. He was arguably the most important moral figure on the planet the last half of the 20th century. And those were his worldly possessions. And I think that really, he really exemplified what it means to walk in the shoes of the fisherman, to be an apostle in this world. I'm not counseling poverty for people who are pastors and so forth. And certainly in Protestantism, these pastors have families, and families need to be sustained and supported. And they should not be groveling in penury, that's for sure. But I think it's very important to resist the siren allure of more, 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 more. Remember yesterday in my second lecture, I started out with that discussion of what I had said in St. Charles Baptist Church in New Orleans about how we've lost the distinction between abundance in the Lord's sense and plenty in our sense, having more, more, more. And I think the having more part has very little to do with the gospel of Jesus Christ, and a lot to do with the gospel of mammon, if I may put it very bluntly, and that we should really try to walk in the shoes of the fishermen as much as possible, knowing that we also, if we have families, do have a particular responsibility to see to it that they are taken care of, to see to it that our children or grandchildren receive good educations, if they have minds to develop, and because God gave us these minds to use and to educate. So walking that line, I think, is often a complicated thing. but the ostentatious display, I don't see anything Christian about that, to be blunt about it. Thank you all very much. Thanks. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. My pleasure. Thank you.